That said and done, I'd like to introduce our first speaker. Stefania Alessino is the president of Capital Link. She started Capital Link a little over a decade ago. Previous to that, she was an investment banker on Wall Street with Bear Stearns and a few other firms, Citibank. And I can tell you she has an extremely interesting idea for you, or set of ideas this evening, on how to find the best funding for you. If you please all welcome Stefania.
Thank you, Walt. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm really excited about being here tonight because I really want to share with you secrets of entrepreneurial finance, which most investment bankers and traditional financial types don't know. If you think about it, it's not too surprising to realize that the expertise it takes to be a very successful financial type is entirely different from what it takes to be a successful entrepreneur. I like to joke about the fact I'm not so sure that investors and entrepreneurs even speak the same language. Have you ever had that experience? Well, I started my career as an entrepreneur. Unfortunately, my first company failed. I didn't have the right funding. Well, when that happened, I vowed that I would never be hostage to capital again. I went to Wall Street to learn the business of finance from the inside out. In the process, I learned some things that were so important, I decided I really wanted to share them with fellow entrepreneurs. And as Walt said, I formed a company, Capital Inc., almost 12 years ago, to share what I learned. Today, I think of myself as a translator between the entrepreneur and the investment community. But make no mistake about it, I'm an entrepreneur first and a financier second. Now, my personal mission in life is to empower business builders to achieve their company's full potential and to never be hostage to capital. In order to accomplish that, I realized I needed to come up with a new approach, and that's exactly what I'd like to share with you this evening. So I'm going to invite you to participate with me in a very proactive, interactive session so that you can get the most out of this for you, because I'd like you to learn some new tools that you can use for yourself. Shall we begin? When I look for an investor, I'm looking for three characteristics. I'm looking for an investor who has the amount of capital that you require. I'm looking for someone who can improve the odds of success for your company. And I'm looking for someone who can help you get to where you want to go. Someone who shares your visions and goals. I have to tell you that I think that shared visions and goals is a pivotal point for selecting the right investor. Now, when I talk about vision, I'm not talking about the soft and fuzzy version of vision. I'm talking about the rigorous definition of vision. Definition defined as your company's core competencies projected forward, assuming resources are not a constraint. If you use that kind of rigor for a definition of vision, you will end up with a reality check. So since vision is such an important piece to this process, I thought perhaps we should create a little bit of space to start out with you being able to revisit your own vision. And in order to be able to accomplish that, I've created a little worksheet for you. And you will find it in the center of your table. Looks like this. The purpose of this worksheet is to really help you to uncover the economic building blocks which build value for your company, to really uncover those core competencies. Now, I'd like to ask you a series of questions that you can start thinking about your own company. The end result of this process will be an actionable way for you to think about your vision and its economic distinctions. Shall we begin? The first question I'd like to ask you is to consider, what are your company's greatest strengths? Now, I'd like you to think about this from the perspective of your customers first, your competition second, but then I'd also like you to think about this from the perspective of maybe your team, things that they might know that the market can't see quite yet. I'm going to give you a moment or two to address those questions. Now, don't forget to add things like your reputation, your customer list, And many of you probably also have proprietary know-how. Okay, I'm going to ask you the second question. What are the greatest weaknesses holding your company back from achieving its potential? But I got a caveat. You can't say cash. Now, it's okay to say what you would use the cash for. So perhaps it's an incomplete management team, or perhaps a marketing campaign. I'll give you a moment or two. Terrific. Now, who are your ideal clients? I don't mean by name. I mean by characteristic. As an example, is your ideal client a multi-site company with sites spread geographically all around the country? Or by chance, is it a small decision-making team that happens to be domiciled a half an hour from your office by driving? Terrific. Now I'd like to share with you a question on market. What market do you serve? And you might think of this in several different ways. First of all, how big is the market? Is it measured in hundreds of millions, or is it in billions? How fast is that market growing? Are you lucky enough to have a triple-digit market, or a double-digit market, or is it single-digit growth? What are the drivers of that marketplace? Is it something unique to your industry, or is it something more general? I'll give you a moment. Okay, who is your competition? And when you are competing against them in the market for your ideal customers, how are they attempting to win business against you? Is it by price, service, brand? Now, before I ask you the last question, I'd like you to reread the answers that you have just written. Because you see, the last question that I'm about to ask you is really a summary question. And the answer to this question needs to be a very unique statement that can only be said about your business so that it captures the economics of your vision. And the question is, what business are you really in? So I'm going to go through these questions and have you reread your answers before you start writing down your answer. What are your company's greatest strengths? What are the major weaknesses holding your company back? Who are your ideal clients? What market do you serve? Who's your competition? And finally, what business are you in? While you're writing your last remarks, I'd like to share with you two examples of clients of mine who went through the exact same brainstorming process that you just did. And for them, they had such perceptions that changed their thinking that I thought by sharing these examples, it might give you a dimension for expanding your own thinking about your answers. The first example I'd like to share with you is Wayne. Wayne produces interior trim for trucks, but not just any kind of trucks. These are 18-wheelers, long-haul trucks, like customers like Packard. Wayne's product is hand-stitched interiors. This is the door panels and the roof and the sun visors. So he thinks of his business as being very labor-intensive and very low-tech. By going through the brainstorming process that we just went through, Wayne revealed a couple of interesting points. He revealed, as an example, that he delivers 7,000 parts and that those parts need to be assembled in color-coordinated packages. Don't forget, there's a right and a left side. And that he has to assemble those color-coordinated items in chassis-specific order for installation. And that his customer demands just-in-time delivery, which Wayne successfully has accomplished with a less than 1% reject rate, despite the fact he is coping with a double-digit turnover in his labor. Ah, revealing these building blocks helped Wayne notice that he had some core competencies that he hadn't included. Core competencies that included logistics, service, and training. As a result of going through this process, Wayne's team no longer thinks of itself as simply being a low-tech business. Rather, he thinks of himself as being high-touch. Let me give you another example other extreme. Scott is in the business of designing motion controllers, which are devices that change the speed and direction of automated production equipment. His customers are factories and plants that are seeking to automate the production movement of raw materials and finished goods. So Scott sort of thinks of his business as sort of a retro engineering business. After all, his motion controller has to fit into the installed base of equipment that's already resident at his customers. So Scott translated this as being the production of a very specialized product serving end users in a very small niche of $250 million. Then we went through the same exercise, and Scott revealed that his company had the ability to produce custom solutions for his customers much more quickly than their competitors, who typically took 6 to 8 weeks. Additional brainstorming further revealed that Scott's team had embedded so much knowledge in its products that they were able to deliver customized solutions right out of inventory by using programmable parts. This revelation of economic building blocks so startled Scott, it caused him to totally rethink his entire business plan. He began to wonder if, in fact, end users were really his ideal customer. You know, end users only buy once or twice a decade. Scott began to think about distributors who actually valued greatly a single product that could be reprogrammed and very quickly solve a wide range of customer problems. And best of all, distributors actually purchase multiple times a week. Based on clarity of his economic building block, Scott's team stopped thinking about themselves as being specialized producers for end users selling a niche market. And they started thinking about themselves as being deliverers of customized solutions to distributors straight out of inventory, serving a $4 billion market. These are the kind of examples that I'm offering you as a way to stimulate your own thinking. And at another point in time, you may want to go back to this exercise that we've just done to uncover the economic building blocks for your own company and see if you've really sharply defined your vision in an operating mode. But the reality is, we have to know that investors are more interested in return on investment than vision. So we don't want to waste time focusing on vision with an investor, but it's perfectly appropriate to sell the economics of that vision. And that's exactly what financial projections are. So my question to you is, what type of financial projections should we share with an investor? Should they be the most aggressive on the one hand? Should they be the most conservative on the other hand? Or would some of you like to do something more in the middle, maybe the most probable? Let's take a vote by hand. How many people say we should show investors the most aggressive plan? Okay, not too many showed up on that one. How many say the most conservative? Got a couple of hands. So, how many people think it ought to be the most probable? Large number of hands. Well, you know, it's really a trick question, because I don't think any of those answers are correct. I think you ought to be showing an investor the optimum financial projection, assuming resources are not a constraint. How would you be spending money if it was your money? So, assuming you could spend money in exactly the way you think appropriate, at what rate would you like to penetrate your market? Boom, you've just established your revenue level. Okay, now, what number of resources does it take to divide the infrastructure to support that revenue level? Boom, you've got your expense line. The rest is math. It just drops to the bottom line. You have to cover this amount of operating deficit. You'll end up with this size business that will support this amount of profit margin, and it'll take you this long to be able to accomplish that. Ladies and gentlemen, your optimum financial projections define the kind of investor that you require. Defined as the size investment they must deliver, the rate of growth that they will tolerate, and the risk-return appetite of the growth strategy you have committed yourself to. Well, now that we've got the concept of the vision that we want our investor to share and the capital characteristics, it's time for us to select our investor. So it's an important time for me to share a very important point with you, and that is that selecting the right investor is not at all about finding him or her. In my opinion, selecting the right investor is all about creating the right investor for you. So let me start off by sharing with you some don'ts so we can dispel some generalities. And these are so onerous, I have to read them because they're so awful. These are things you do not want to do. You do not want to do mass mailings to a directory of investors. You do not want to send out information to Dear Sir or to whom it may concern. You don't want to broadcast to investors the percent of ownership you are willing to give up. You don't want to stop looking after the first investor actually engages you in one or two meetings. You don't want to assume that money people are doing you a favor. Don't accept money from an investor for whom you have a negative gut feeling. Don't accept money that is less than what is required for your vision. And most importantly, never, never, never change your vision in order to get money from an investor. Okay. So if all those are things that we're not going to do, what are we going to do? Well, the answer is I've got a 4-step action plan for you, and I'd like to share it with you. The first step is an anonymous corporate resume, which articulates your vision in economic terms. A corporate resume is a 1-to-3-page document which uniquely describes your business but never uses your company's name. In order to create a document that succinct, in which an outsider can really understand your business, you need to use the language of finance, which is dollars and cents. So you need to really distill the economic building blocks which speak to the investor economics of your business. Interestingly enough, let me show you a picture of a corporate resume. And you'll notice that the paragraphs, strangely, come right out of the worksheet you just did. Business and market come right out of the worksheet you just did. Strategy and investment are extrapolations. Strengths and weaknesses, another word for, we did both strengths and issues. Competition we did as well. Financial perspective is actually just the write-up of the financial projections, which are the optimum financial projections, assuming unlimited resources. And most importantly, you never want to forget about the bios of management, because that's what really converts any growth strategy into a credible scenario. Now, what's really powerful about a corporate resume is that it is the key step in being able to convert your strategy into a currency investors are willing to acquire. That makes this a very, very powerful tool. And the definition of a corporate resume is what you know you know. So the next step in the process is the backdoor approach to find out what you don't know you don't know. After all, what sophisticated company would ever embark on a major commercial rollout without doing significant research of a market nature? Probably doing beta tests with a couple of key customers and things of that nature. Well, the backdoor approach is just that. An opportunity to uncover relevant and real-time financial market intelligence so that you can educate yourself not only about your funding options in the current marketplace, but to test your growth strategy before you expose your reputation in the marketplace. How do you do this? Well, you circulate that anonymous corporate resume to professional investors. Why investors? Because investors are the perfect mirror for you, the entrepreneur. Think about this. When an investor invests, they are at stake in exactly the same way you are today as an owner. But before they invest, they are the most perfect form of objective feedback. After all, investors are in the business of analyzing companies based on strengths and weaknesses, so that they may decide where to put their money to work. Best of all, investors are constantly looking at deals, so they can peer out into the future. They can provide insight about competition and technology. These are exactly the same issues that you need to know about positioning your company for success. So the backdoor approach is a key step for any company in a growth mode. Let me give you an example how this worked for Wayne. I secured financial market intelligence from 12 venture capitalists to be sure that I was getting a balanced scenario to feed back to Wayne. Now, you know that Wayne's in the trucking industry, but I was a little concerned that financial investors in the trucking field might be a little too conservative for Wayne's unusual business model. So I included investors who were knowledgeable in logistics and service and training. And even though Wayne's company is located right here in Illinois, I chose investors that had locations where Wayne wanted to be, in Oregon, in Ohio. Well, in short order, I got the feedback, and it wasn't very good. I shared it with Wayne. The fact of the matter was, investors were concerned that Wayne did most of his business with a single customer. 95% of his business was with Packard. Well, in discussing this with Wayne, we uncovered some interesting points. Wayne shared with me that he was actually getting premium prices from Packard. And then Wayne explained to me that while Packard has over 100 vendors, Wayne's company is the only one that is sole sourced. And then Wayne explained to me that he had been invited by Packard to work with Packard's engineers to see if he could redesign some of the products and was responsible for overseeing the quality of some of the other vendors. By the way, these were all points about his own company that Wayne missed. So he certainly wasn't in a very good position to be able to sell them to investors. As a result of the anonymous feedback from the backdoor approach, Wayne was able to take a proactive approach to eradicate misunderstandings that could have literally prohibited his ability to raise money. Based on this feedback, we were able to convert customer concentration, which is bad, to customer penetration, which is economically attractive. And better yet, as a result of this process, Wayne was able to reposition his company to get credit for a much more compelling economic relationship with his customer than he had previously offered the investor marketplace. That brings us to step 3, creation of a value-building plan designed for fast, favorable investor reactions. The creation of this special value-building plan is designed to answer the investor questions that are revealed in the back door. It's basically an opportunity to further amplify on the building blocks that you started to uncover. But please take note, this is not a business plan that's edited from some other plan that you wrote for your operating team. This has to be molded in specific market response to what the investors asked. As a result, this plan does not have a generic outline of what is included. Let me give you an example. I'm working with a client that happens to be addressing the market of energy deregulation. I don't think there's any state in the union that isn't aware of the problems that California is having. It's covering all the news. So when we went out into the marketplace, no backdoor investor had any question about the fact that there was a market demand here. What we uncovered, however, was that they were all unsure, in light of the politics, what a profit model looked like. As a result, the business plan we developed for this company dispensed with market in one paragraph, but it took 90% of its time to focus on the business model at hand. Now, while many things are going to be very unique in your unique business plan here, one thing that I will tell you should be a general statement. Keep it short. I suggest you attempt to keep it to 12 pages of text. And it's okay to include things like appendices and financial projection assumptions and things of that nature, but keep it short. Okay, now we're up to step 4. Enter the market through the front door to create the best investor for you. The definition of the front door is to be able to enter a market with face-to-face meetings with the right investors based on the economically tested business model. Okay, you know what the right investors are going to look like. So now let's talk about what is this tested economic model I'm referring to. Easy. That's the one you beta tested with the backdoor approach, the one that you tweaked with the financial market intelligence that you got back, that you documented in the value-building business plan, and have concrete answers to all of investor questions. So here we are. We're in the process of putting in front of investors your business. So now what we've got is the opportunity to have investors take a look at this dialogue. Let me tell you what the objectives here are. You have two goals with the front door approach. The first is to be able to establish a market value for your company. The second is to be able to have choices of investor personalities. I think you'll like this third one. It's to get the highest valuation. That's not just a good idea. It's absolutely critical. In fact, it's a mathematical confirmation that you are talking with investors who see risk, who see opportunity where others see risk. And it's one that really shares your visions and goals. But you don't want to miss the points of terms and conditions, so we'll have to pay attention to that. My favorite example of creating the best investor using the front door is Scott. Scott met with 13 investors in 8 states. Why so many? He was trying to get investor feedback so that he could evaluate it. Interestingly enough, Scott was surprised to see how investors reacted so differently to his company's strengths and weaknesses. He was learning that value is not objective. Value is a matter of perception. He was also getting a handle on what he saw as the different personalities in investors and what personalities he could deal with and he was comfortable with and which ones he wasn't. With each investor, he explained his vision. And interestingly enough, one of the investors really engaged a dialogue about the distributor piece. Ultimately, Scott ended up with 5 term sheets. And the investor who dialogued with him about the distributor was the one that came up with the highest valuation. But you know what? We didn't accept that valuation. We didn't accept that term sheet. We wrote a 6th term sheet. The 6th term sheet had the best terms and conditions of all the others and the best valuation. And then Scott went ahead and invited the 2 investors he liked best. One was the investor that had the highest valuation, but interestingly enough, the other investor was one that actually had the lowest valuation. But Scott really liked his rigor, and he invited him in. Both joined Scott, and as a result, Scott's company took off. Scott's company did achieve $100 million in sales, but it didn't take 5 years. He accomplished it in 1 year from funding. And the real story of Scott and Wayne are available in these little brochures that are out in the front, along with where you picked up your name tags. But the reality is, this particular strategy that I've shared with you here is one that applies to a broad spectrum of investors. So it's important to know where you're going to get the most favorable feedback. You see, investors have different risk-taking appetites. So what you really want to do is be able to evaluate the differences and capitalize on the complementary role different investors can play with your company as it grows. The benefit is to be able to have escalating valuations. To help you capitalize on these different investor types, let me define private equity in 3 sectors: family, angels, and professional investors. Family and friends are the kind of investors that the entrepreneur has an unusual amount of clout with. After all, would your mother or your best friend ever deny you? Well, when you're a startup company and your business is really based on an idea, the only asset you have is integrity. And the only person that can acquire integrity is someone for whom it already exists. That's why family and friends are oftentimes the only source of financing at the early stage startup. And the reality is, if somebody who knows you won't invest, why should anybody else? So it's a good place to go when you're looking for funding. The angels are another form of investment. Angels are simply sophisticated business people who are very successful, who have enough money that they can afford to invest on a discretionary basis, almost as a hobby. Well, these angels actually have the opportunity to invest anywhere from $100 to $1 million, but they do have limitations. They'll only invest in businesses that they personally understand from an operations standpoint. As a result, angels are ideal sources of funding when you are initiating marketing, because an angel has their own personal business knowledge to be able to help make their investment decisions. And a little bit like you as an entrepreneur, they are willing to take entrepreneurial gambles in the face of scant evidence. Finally, you've got the professional venture. The professional investor, think of them as somebody who is investing as a full-time job. Portfolio managers, managing the funds of each of their clients who are insurance companies and pension funds. In today's market, these investors are managing over hundreds of millions of dollars, and they need to put $5 million or more to work in each client. Now, even though they can put that kind of money to work, they have limitations. They can only invest in companies which they can prudently analyze because they are acting as a fiduciary and have a responsibility as the agent of their clients. As a result, the best time to go to professional investors is when you have a company that is ready to roll out your product. Frankly, professional investors are the ones that have the deep enough pockets to be able to finance that thing. But more importantly, that's the first time that you actually have the evidence that a professional investor needs to document. So ultimately, in order to be able to take advantage of these different investors, you need to understand how to capitalize on them. Remember that family and friends invest cheap when you don't have anything much to show, that financial angels are willing to value your company based on what's possible, not what's there, and that the professional investor can only invest based on what they can document. When you hear about the public markets, that's what the masses will buy, and you better be ready to jump on it when it's available. So I'd like to turn this over to my fellow speakers and have them share with you their insights about how to capitalize on the different factors in this marketplace. But I want you to remember, whatever environment you find yourself when you're doing your next round of financing, I hope you will use these tools to create the best investor for you.
Thank you.